Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel of New Books Network. I'm Julia Gossard. Today I'm talking to Professor Judith Coffin at the University of Texas at Austin about her new book, Sex, Love, and Letters, Writing Simone de Beauvoir. When Judy Coffin discovered a virtually unexplored treasure trove of letters to Simone de Beauvoir from her international readers, it inspired Coffin to explore the intimate bond between the famed author and her reading public. This correspondence at the heart of Sex, Love, and Letters immerses us in the tumultuous decades of the late 1940s to the 1970s, from the painful aftermath of World War II to the horror and shame of French colonial brutality in Algeria, and through the dilemmas and exhilarations of the early gay liberation and feminist movements.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Judy. I really appreciate you taking some time to talk about Sex, Love, and Letters, Writing Simone de Beauvoir.
I'm very glad that you're doing this, Julia. It's a pleasure to talk about it with you. I've known you for a long time, and we've had a lot of good gender conversations. So I'm looking forward to another.
Yes. I started reading your book and I absolutely love these opening lines. It really took me back to Paris to doing research and being at both the Bibliothèque Nationale and the Archives Nationales, and both the passion and excitement that you have, as well as somewhat of the intimidation factor that comes along with being at these institutions. And I just love that in especially a trying time where we're not getting to travel as much, you really bring us back to the archives and to thinking about this methodology.
I'm very glad that worked. I still remember writing that.
You mentioned in the introduction a little bit about this, but where did the inspiration for this work come from?
Well, it's one of those cases where you really stumble on something. Because as I say in the introduction, I was writing something else. I was writing a review essay and I heard of these letters. And then I saw them. I saw them with great difficulty the first time. They're cataloged now and a couple of other wonderful young historians are working on them. But at that time, they weren't cataloged. And I still remember the day that I first read them. And I was glued to my chair for, I would say, 6 or 7 hours. That's very unusual for me. I love to eat and go out and wander around Paris, but I just was glued to my chair. They're so direct, and they're so dramatic, and they're so thoughtful, and the letter writers are so hungry for conversation and thoughtful about their lives, and they have such different voices and different handwritings and come from different situations. So I was completely seduced by them. I later learned that seductiveness is part of what letters are about. I think I was a little naive about letters, and you know, letters try to recreate a conversation. Letters try to create a sense of intimacy and immediacy and directness. So I actually then got interested in the letterness of the letters, in what it meant to write a letter and what it meant to communicate. So I first thought I would write about the social and cultural history of post-war France through the letters. And then I realized that the letters themselves had to be the center of the book and the relationship that produced them, the reading that produced them, the historical moment that produced them. So as often happens, then you know this, you know, the archive becomes not just your source, mm-hmm. but your subject.
Yeah. And I think that's very obvious in your work that these letters are forming their own archive in many ways. And I think you present to readers this really great examination of what is letter writing, right? And what is the relationship between the letter writer and the receiver and even you as the reader as sort of this, you know, peer into people's identities.
Yes. The sense that you're reading over somebody's shoulder. Right, mm-hmm. Creates all kinds of challenges that I hadn't thought about.
And you make it quite clear that these letters themselves are their own type of archive, and that letters and writings to Beauvoir were not some random act of her just collecting and keeping them. These are a very conscious decision on Beauvoir's part to keep these and to create almost an archive of those letters. And you say they demonstrate her beliefs about, quote, writing, life, and philosophy. So they offer not only the source base of this book, but also a deeper understanding of the post-war world in terms of identity and gender and sexuality. What do you think that by studying those letters, we can tell more about this period? I mean, obviously, you were going to work on just a topic of sort of post-war social and cultural history through those letters and then expanded it to Beauvoir. So what does this give us?
Oh, gosh, it gives us a lot. Let me start with the question about what it shows us about Beauvoir. I figured this out relatively late in the project. She saved these letters because she was very interested. She was passionately interested in her readers. Partly she was interested in showing that her ideas landed and that her arguments were right. She said, readers gave my work its truth. But she also meant by that her ideas, that philosophy for her is about grappling with consciousness, with lived experience, with everyday life, with the world as it unfolds. And so these letters in which readers told her about reading, about their lives, about their marriages, about their politics, these weren't just stories. They're sort of the stuff of philosophy. Mm. These are thinkers. These are ideas that encounter in their encounter with the everyday. So I think we learned that about Beauvoir. We also learned that, you know, the second sex isn't the only or even necessarily the most influential thing that she writes. What these readers are writing about are her memoirs.
Right.
And it's her memoirs and her life story or what she chooses to tell us about her life story that really lands with a very large public and again makes her more abstract ideas concrete. I mean, gender is so many things, right? Gender is a division of labor, a division of responsibilities, including emotional responsibilities in the family. Gender is a cultural formation. So we learn gender is a way of organizing sexual desire, and we learn all about the different ways in which those issues came up. The stuff on sexuality is interesting and would probably take more time to really get through. We see people grappling with the categories of sexual knowledge that were available at the time, and they are so inadequate to understanding what they are feeling, their desires, their relationships. That part of the sexuality was very very interesting to me. And you know, identity, we learn all about the many, many different ways of living one's life, living the female condition, if you will. And, you know, the post-war France and post-war Europe in general, and the United States too, and elsewhere in the world, is a time of enormous economic expansion. It's the 30 glorious years, it's called in France. Consumerism, economic expansion, expanding employment, expanding prosperity. And in some ways, what these letters show is the dark side of that, just how much that's about labor, more children, more care of the household. So it shows the sort of private side of the history of those post-war years.
Definitely. I think one of the more interesting things about these letters is you do sense from reading your words about these letters that there's a quite amount of tension in people's understandings of where their sexuality fits, where their behavior fits, where their identity fits. And they're using Beauvoir almost as a sounding board in many ways to figuring this out. They've read her memoirs, they've read her letters. And by the fact that Beauvoir is just writing about herself, they take it as an opportunity to tell Beauvoir about themselves as well.
That's exactly right. And they try to do it sometimes using her categories of thought. That's particularly true in the case of sexuality. And they show pretty clearly when those categories work and when they don't. So she at once sort of nudges them to explain themselves. She gives them a handful of ideas that they can use. She gives them a model. She gives them, I guess at some point I call it a scaffolding. You know, her mm-hmm. life story gives them a scaffolding to talk about theirs, to say, I'm like you, or I'm exactly not like you. And the fact that she says so much about herself, although we know she didn't tell us everything, far from right. it. The fact that she says so much is a kind of invitation to them to do the same.
And I think what's also really interesting about these letters, too, is that there's a sense that they aren't all fan letters, right? They aren't all, you know, you're the greatest existentialist philosopher of all time. You know, I love your work.
They get downright argumentative.
Yes, they do. And in the conclusion and in chapter 8, you point out when she posits in All Said and Done that orgasm was a psychosomatic phenomenon, for example, she had people writing to her with extensive skepticism and shock and almost bewilderment and confusion and pushing back against her too. So you see the ways in which the public is actually becoming involved in some of these very interesting discussions about sexuality and the body and identity during this period.
Yeah, they know so much more in the late 60s and early 70s than they did in the 50s. It's hard to imagine those kinds of letters coming in the 1950s. But by the late 60s, people who have read The Myth of the Vaginal Orgasm and other, you know, what we now know are kind of classics about women's sexual pleasure, are writing back and saying, you don't know what you're talking about. And that was funny to see how they're not always deferential. They're very respectful. They Beauvoir is plainly a major figure in their life, but they don't feel that they have to defer to her, and they don't sort of cling on her every word. They're hungry for a conversation, but they really do feel themselves to be her interlocutors at some level.
And this is a question I didn't provide to you on the list that I gave to you before, but as we're talking, it makes me wonder, do you think part of that desire to want to have this conversation with Beauvoir and viewing her as sort of this interlocutor is because of her gender? She's perhaps more approachable as a woman versus, you know, writing to Sartre or somebody else, right, about some of these same issues.
Yes, absolutely. It's hard to imagine them writing a male author in quite the same way. And there's a sort of ready-made template for writing to a another woman, which is the, you know, letters from the heart or the or the advice column. And, you know, and Beauvoir gets kind of irritated that people think of her as writing an advice column. And the readers quite insist, I'm not writing to you in this genre. I'm not writing for you to pat me on the head and say, there, you know, little girl, everything will be fine. I'm thinking about my life and I want to have a conversation with a woman, but a woman who is also a serious thinker. And so, sure, the fact that she's a woman, the fact that she's a celebrity, the fact that she writes her memoirs, I think that's what makes the most difference. But that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why these letters get drawn into this mode of advice column, get drawn into what I call the kind of magnetic force of women's culture. Which is really interesting to see how that works out.
As you're discussing these letter writers and the changes between, say, the 1950s and the 1960s and 70s, is their education, right? Is the fact that they are becoming much more comfortable talking about sexuality, much more well-versed in philosophy and the construction of knowledge right alongside Beauvoir's writings as well? So you can see the way that that exploded in post-war France, the United States, and Europe at large, the way people are really buying almost as a consumer entity too.
Well, yes. I mean, I will tell you, my first encounter with the second sex was probably when I was, you know, 12 years old, and I was homesick for the day, and I was looking around on my mother's bookshelf, and I found the second sex, and I said, oh, this is going to teach me something about sex. Well, there was a lot more than I bargained for, but I don't think that was uncommon. I mean, the American reviews are wonderful. They say, oh, there is perhaps a little too much about sexuality in here, or, oh, she really goes all out. You know what Kate Mann, the author of Down Girl, calls the gory details of sexuality are really resonant for a lot of people. And by the time we get into the late 60s, you can really see people making sense of that. I think it's kind of bewildering to many in the 50s. Although one of the things I want to add this about sexual knowledge is how unbelievably patchy it is, how uneven it is, how what you know, since there's no, you know, national curriculum, there's very little discussion, what you know really depends on whether or not you heard something from your parents, your friends, an aunt, whether you live in a city or in the countryside. I mean, the gap between what some people know and what some people are completely ignorant about is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can tell that a little bit when you start discussing, I think it's in chapter two, you start talking a little bit about the rise of Kinsey right alongside Beauvoir and how this helps to carry the second sex into commercial women's press. But within these women's presses, you have Beauvoir, you know, writing in Perry Match or in Elle, but there's a lot of patchiness between what is serialized and publicized and what is the true essence of Beauvoir too.
Yeah, although I don't think that there's necessarily a true essence of, well, of course there is. And but that's not my project. There are so many people who've written so many brilliant books about Beauvoir. You know, I don't want to go into that territory. I'm interested in the Beauvoir that lands in how it gets the conversations that gets pulled into, public or private, the relationships that it builds, the issues that it helps people puzzle over. So for me, the fact that it's pulled into Perry Match is great, right? I saw that cover of Perry Match and I said, oh, this is completely fantastic, with the guy wearing the movie star wearing his fishnet t-shirt and then an advertisement for the second sex across the street.
I actually went and looked up the cover when I was reading it in your book because I thought, oh, I've got to see what this looks like.
I know. I wonder. And you know, it's very hard to get permission to use anything from Perry Match. Anything involving Beauvoir image-wise is extremely expensive. I wanted to publish that that image, but you know, it would have cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars. So I didn't. But you found it on the web, right?
I found it on the web. Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. It really adds quite a bit to this juxtaposition of what's going on there.
I know. Well, all of these juxtapositions are wonderful. There's the juxtaposition of, I mean, Beauvoir and Kinsey. Who ever thought, I mean, I certainly had never thought of the Kinsey Report alongside the Second Sex. And now I'm doing a project on another book that I never thought of alongside The Second Sex, but that's Story of O, which is, you know, the kind of famous erotic novel of the 1950s, which comes out of exactly the same moment as The Second Sex. So I'm always intrigued by this, these incongruous pairings and what they show about the history of a given moment.
That was probably one of my favorite chapters in thinking about, you know, this foundational work on sexuality and Beauvoir in conjunction with it and the way that we can read those two kind of in conversation with one another.
No, I was just going to say what it shows about how, you know, sex, this is why I coined this term that I like, mid-century sex, and it means everything. It means there's nothing that is not somehow brought back to, incorporated into, explained by sex. And that's what people can think, that Beauvoir and Kinsey are writing about the same thing, even though we now go, well, you know, these two books have nothing to do with each other. But it's very interesting about the capaciousness of sex as a topic in the 1950s.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to go back to something that you said about how you're not wading into you know, particular territories about Beauvoir. And I think that the thing that surprised me the most just from the title is that this is not a biography of Beauvoir, although she is certainly the anchor of this. This is really about her ideas and how those letter writers demonstrate these ideas in this culture and society that's ever changing.
Yeah, it's really not a biography of Beauvoir, and I think you put it very nicely when you say that she's the anchor, she's the occasion, she's the person who put this archive together by saving the letters. But I really, you know, the book really aims in some way to decenter her. I mean, I was mm-hmm. trained as a social and cultural historian. Study the history of ordinary people, and I wanted them to be the center of attention, and their lives and their thoughts about their lives to be the center of attention. I don't think that one should cabin off intellectual history from social and cultural history, and it is an intellectual history in some ways, but it's not a biography of Beauvoir, and it's not a study of her work. It's a study of her relationships or readers' relationships with her, and then what that tells us about the world in which that relationship takes shape.
I think that that's really apparent in chapters 3 and 4. Maybe it's readers and writers. You really point out, you know, this is about these people who have read Beauvoir. There's almost Beauvoir the person, Beauvoir the celebrity, and then Beauvoir this sort of entity of ideas in many ways.
Right, exactly.
And it's much more about that Beauvoir, the entity of ideas, because you also have people back to thinking about this sort of patchiness of sexual knowledge. You have them writing to her for medical knowledge as well. And it seems like Beauvoir's sometimes willing to give that advice, and at other times is like, why is somebody writing to me about this?
Yeah. And I do... I don't wish I had answers to those questions. I mean, I think it's more fun to just think about them and imagine her reading these letters. I have one letter that gives you a wonderful sense of how it sat on her desk, because somebody's written a shopping list for a get together of friends on the back of it. It says, you know, so and so should bring little toasts, and And so you can see that these letters just piled up on her desk. But people see that she's writing about sex, and people have really pressing questions. There's no contraception is illegal. Abortion is illegal. So these are big questions. The biggest question is how you avoid getting pregnant, which is why I have this one wonderful letter from a man saying, I can't remember how many children, I have 4 children, and I really need to know how not to have any more.
Yeah.
Because my wife doesn't want to do this anymore.
It's very interesting the ways that people look to these sort of touchstones or cornerstones of what they think of as sexual knowledge as this advice giving during this era.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what they need. They need advice.
Yeah.
Right? They're not just interested in sexuality as a subject. They need to manage their everyday lives. Mm-hmm. And their everyday lives are sometimes a big mess. I mean, yeah. I'm really impressed by the resilience of these characters. And what they managed to get through.
I want to talk about a point you make in your first chapter where you're deconstructing sort of our collective memory of the second sex. I think academics in particular will find this chapter very helpful in thinking about sort of the legacy of Beauvoir. And you take us back to 1949. And reading this chapter in 2020 when we are, celebrating the century of female suffrage for white women. I'm very struck by what you say about women's suffrage in 1944, France. This is Beauvoir is actually seeming to be somewhat irritated by the fanfare around female suffrage in 1944, going so far as to say, are there women really? And this seems to be kind of a point that reading that in 2020, I'm so struck by this.
It's so interesting because the oldest cliche about the second sex is that it's ahead of its time.
Right.
And so one of my most simple arguments is it's not. It's completely of its time. And if one plunks it back into 1949, it seems very different. It's a self-consciously post-feminist book.
Mm-hmm.
Beauvoir is really, you're absolutely right. She's completely impatient. Suffrage has happened, and so what?
Yeah.
She's so impatient. She said, we have to start all over again. We have to rethink the question of women's inequality or the female condition, or as she would put it, the relationship of the female condition to the human condition. Suffrage is a very narrow issue. I mean, you said that yourself when you say it's white women's feminism, white women's suffrage. And that's very much the reputation that feminism has in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't lots of really interesting people writing what we would now see as feminist things, but they're laboring under the image of feminism as a narrow, bourgeois, white European movement. And Beauvoir, like many other radicals, is interested in this much broader world of, the emergence of anti-colonial movements, what will become the emergence of the civil rights movement. And feminism makes her feel claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And she's gotten a kind of bad rap for this. And one of the things I wanted to do was, sort out her position and her feelings because they were so plainly echoed by her readers.
Mm-hmm.
So what feminism means changes from the late 40s to the late 60s is one of the things that I'm interested in here. How is it that radical feminism explodes in the aftermath of 1968?
Right.
She's very ambivalent about feminism, but that's interesting to me. For me, that's not a reason to pillory her, but it's a reason to explore it.
Right. And in this way in which, you know, we have kind of held this up as a work of feminist thought, at least colloquially, right? And the ways in which she doesn't mm-hmm. quite think about it that way. And chapter six does this as well, where we see how right. the conversation surrounding decolonization, the Algerian War, 1968, really revitalizes the second sex in many ways, that people are going back to this, looking at it and thinking about the decolonization of the soul as well. And she's really pushing this ideology. And, you know, she's questioning, has the role of women in the 1960s really changed?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you're absolutely right. And I think I call it, you know, the second sex gets a second life in the 1960s. That's not necessarily because her arguments have changed.
Right.
It's because the, you know, the sort of world of ideas and analogies has changed. I mean, obviously the social world is very different and the cultural world is very different, but in the aftermath of the Algerian War, suddenly, and the emergence of civil rights in the United States, I think that is also very important. These analogies between movements to liberate colonial peoples, Black power, and women's liberation, those analogies make sense mm-hmm. in a way that they hadn't, in a mainstream way, people were blind to before then. And one of the things that's interesting is that the Second Sex's first life is as a post-war book. Mm-hmm. It's post-World War II. And its second life is post-war as well, as post-Algerian war. So, you know, the book stays the same, but it's read in very different ways. It's also read through her memoir. So now right. people have some sense of what to make of it.
Yeah. And what to make about Beauvoir writing it as well, and what that all meant.
Exactly. That becomes the sort of the framework for it. I mean, it's a very big book. The Second Sex is a very big book, and people kind of ricochet off it in very different ways. It's very hard to grasp the full meaning of it in 1949.
And I think that that's what, you know, Sex, Love, and Letters does really well, is it explains that, you know, the second sex is important, but these memoirs are important to read with it as well, and that people are interpreting it for their own lives. They're taking it as points of either acceptance or discourse and debate as well within themselves.
Right, right. Taking it into their lives. It's meant to show too that, and I hope this comes through, that books are important.
Yeah.
You know, books are a big deal. Reading is really exciting to people. There's a kind of democratization of education mm-hmm. and conversation, and it's still a very hierarchical literary world. But you can see there's a sort of thirst for big ideas on the part of, you know, not particularly privileged people.
Yeah. I think one of the more interesting methodological, or maybe one of the more challenging methodological aspects of your book is that while you have this treasure trove of letters, and they've created their archive themselves, you don't always have Beauvoir's response. And the way in which you had to often imagine what her response would have been, I think you do masterfully, but I think that would be hard for many scholars to be able to do.
Well, there aren't any of her answers in there, I should say. It's clear that she does answer, because they say, thank you so much for writing to me. Oh, I was so thrilled to get your letter. And I do have, and since the book's been published, a couple of people have written me to say, oh, you know, I got a letter from Simone de Beauvoir.
That's really cool.
I was actually glad to have it one way, because it's a one-way correspondence, because as you say, that frees up a little more space for imagining mm-hmm. the dialogue. And that was really fun to do. And because, to be honest, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of pages written by Simone de Beauvoir. So we're not at any loss for her ideas. And the other thing is that in those thousands of pages, she writes about her readers quite a lot.
Right.
I mean, that was why it was quite clear to me that this was a dialogue, because she'd say, oh, my readers wrote to me about their marriages, or I've asked you, my readers, to be my collaborators. Please read all the way to the end of this book. This is going to be a difficult book. So she's very, for the same reasons that she saved these letters, she's very self-conscious about her readers and being in dialogue with them. So that part of it, not having her answers was easy. The hard part that was fun but was hard was bringing these readers to life and capturing what made each of them an individual, mm-hmm. while at the same time saying something that was more broadly significant about the cultural moment. And that, you know, that did take a lot of work,
yeah.
translating them, I mean, among other things, and only using snippets because they have to remain anonymous. So I couldn't identify them in any way. So bringing them to life without identifying them was a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, because this is, you know, such a recent history that some of these people are very much still alive, you know, and involved, you know.
One of her correspondents, who I can't name, but who sent Beauvoir her diaries, has given them to the Philippe Lejeune has an Institute for the Study of Autobiography, and she's given those diaries to them. So we know who some of these people are, but you know, one respects their privacy.
If you could give advice for, you know, popular readers who might be very interested in sort of the life and ideas of Simone de Beauvoir, of how they might, you know, approach this work and read it for themselves.
Well, I think everybody should read a book however they want to read it. I don't think you have to start at the beginning and go all the way through. You can bounce around until you get something that grabs your attention. If you want something, the more biographical part of on Beauvoir is chapter 3, where, you know, she sort of becomes a celebrity and begins to write her memoirs. If you're interested in the political history of the Algerian War, there are two chapters on that. One of my favorite chapters is the chapter on marriage, actually, because there's such a deep misunderstanding of what she's saying, and she keeps trying to correct her readers, and they keep not getting it, but saying, "We love you anyway." And I just, I really enjoyed that part. She writes a short story that is based, among other things, on her readers' letters. It's not a short story in which her readers come out very sympathetically, and the readers don't care.
Right.
Right. So there are lots of, yeah, the marriage chapter, I think, is quite vivid. If one's interested in feminism, the legal battles over contraception, chapter 8 is interesting. And if one's interested in the sort of odd ways in which the second sex is read in the 1940s, then you begin at the beginning. But I think you can plunge into it at just about any point.
Well, thank you so much, Judy, for joining me to talk about sex, love, and letters. It has been a real pleasure.
It was really terrific. Thank you for doing this. I'm thrilled to talk about it.
For your own copy of Sex, Love, and Letters, please visit Cornell University Press. Thank you to Cornell University Press for a review copy of this book. I'll see you next time on New Books in History. Happy reading.